singing an Urdu poem by Allama Iqbal.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time station manager to oversee administrative, fundraising, and business functions. Nonprofit management experience required. To apply, go to kboo.fm/station manager hire or visit our website. Deadline to apply is Friday, April 7th. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Biden in Canada. What's Haiti got to do with this visit? Also, Harvey Wasserman warns in a new counterpunch piece, control of the White House and Congress may be decided in April in Wisconsin, and the Democrats may be set to blow it. And fighting against dangerous weapons in space, will speak to Bruce Gagnon, founder of Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we begin with Haiti again. Haiti, always in the crossroads, in the crosshairs of U.S., deadly U.S. foreign policy. Today, we saw a little like a behind-the-scenes action happening when the President of the United States went to Canada, Kevin Pina, and apparently there was some wheeling and dealing to sort of take a little of the pressure off of the United States in terms of its destabilization program and get Haiti to take some of the blows for the occupation. You want to sort of bring us up to speed?
Well, I mean, really what it is sort of double-handed. On one hand, they're saying that they're going to increase the number of refugees who can come in legally, but at the meantime, folks who are involved in immigration in Canada are saying that last year there were 40,000 who applied to come to Canada, and under the new rules, there are only going to be 15,000 allowed to legally migrate into Canada. It's the same sort of shell game that Biden is playing with the so-called humanitarian parole that is aimed at Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, and Haitians. and Cubans. It's intended, of course, to call out what they consider to be undesirable regimes in Central America, with the exception, of course, of Haiti. And Haiti is a U.S. surrogate at this point. Haiti is a country that is reeling from a U.S. intervention, a U.S.-led intervention of the so-called core group, which are nations in Latin America and Europe who have, since the 2004 coup that ousted the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, really the true rulers of Haiti. We know that after Aristide was forced out in 2004, that the United Nations had a 13-year, five-month United Nations military occupation of the country, where the core group had near total power over all of Haiti's institutions. So Haiti really does not fit in the same basket that Biden and Trudeau are discussing, because, again, Canada was also part of that same coup d'etat. We know that much of the plot was hatched inside of in Ottawa 2 years prior to the 2004 coup. So Canada and the U.S., on one hand, are talking about increasing legally the ability of Haitians to come into the United States. On the other hand, it's actually limiting the ability of those who don't have the resources to get on a plane, who don't have contacts with people in this country or in Canada to help sponsor them, to leave. It's really a very, very focused policy on a focus group of people who have the resources, who have the contacts to be able to leave the country. And of course, that leaves out the majority of Haitians who, again, are really the victims of a policies led by the United States government that has basically destroyed their sovereignty and has led to the situation where it's a slow bleed on the population to this day. Haiti lost its political sovereignty in 2004, and it has yet to regain it. The government of Ariel Henry today in Haiti is a government that is only able to remain in power by virtue of support of the Biden administration of U.S. foreign policy. The so-called gangs in Haiti today are now being labeled by Haitians as not just gangs, but as paramilitary forces, paramilitary gangs. Why? Because they are seen as largely doing the bidding of the state, the U.S.-backed government of Ariel Henry, by virtue of keeping the country destabilized so that those neighborhoods in the capital, those neighborhoods in other areas of the country that have led protest after protest against Martelly, against Jovenel Moïse, against the PHTK government, ruling party government that was put into power by Hillary Rodham Clinton in a direct intervention in 2011 in that country. Really, those protests and those neighborhoods where resistance has been strongest historically by Haitians are now occupied by paramilitary forces that have ties to the police and are seen now as an almost internal occupying military, paramilitary force at the behest of the government. And it is a campaign that they are viewing as low-intensity conflict being waged on them on a daily basis.
Okay, just to harden up the image. So essentially, in terms of today's policies in Biden in Canada, to be clear, the idea is to use Canada as sort of a human or countrywide human shield to disguise the brutality of U.S. destabilization policy. And it is a policy of destabilization. And it's often hard, Kevin, to understand why the United States would want to destabilize Haiti, given they know that the folks are going to end up at the U.S. doorstep. Of course, we're seeing some extraordinary brutality in terms of U.S. response to Haitians. But help us understand more about the context here, because it's who would support this kind of policy?
Well, there's a lot at stake that people don't realize in Haiti economically on several levels. We know that Haiti helps to hold down the bottom of the price of wage labor in the hemisphere. They're among the lowest paid workers, and we know that if wages were to rise in Haiti, they would rise around the entire region. So Haiti serves that purpose. Often major multinational corporations will use Haiti as a threat against other workforces in Central America and the Caribbean, say we're going to move our operations there in order to forestall demand for higher wages and better working conditions in other countries, because Haiti again holds down the bottom and has the worst conditions of any of the workers in the region. That's one reason. The other reason is that, remember that Haiti's 1987 constitution, while it doesn't use the word nationalize, it does in fact say that Haiti's wealth, mineral wealth and resources are for the benefit of the national collectivity of the people of Haiti, meaning that if they are exploited, they are supposed to be used directly to fund programs, to help to lift the standard of living of the average Haitian. That's written into Haiti's 1987 constitution. It also makes it very difficult for foreign ownership of mineral rights in the country. Now, we know that the corrupt government of Martelly and the PHTK had made several sweetheart deals for mining rights with several U.S. and Canadian companies. We know that some of them are right now involved in those mining activities, which actually are seen as illegal because they were never approved by Parliament. There was never a majority of a Parliament to be able to approve them according to the 1987 Constitution. And so that's what's really on the table here, this rush towards the next elections, which are not only designed to continue the status quo, if you will, of the Ariel Henry government, which is definitely a creature of U.S. foreign policy, but also to allow for a constitutional referendum that would roll back that de facto nationalization that is enshrined in the 1987 Haitian Constitution, which then would, of course, would open the door to widespread exploitation of what is seen as possibly one of the largest deposits of iridium in the world. It's estimated there are nearly 300 tons of raw iridium under Haiti's land. And if you look at the price of iridium today, you'll see how much that's worth. It's worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. If those companies were able to roll back the 1987 Constitution, have a government in power that would roll back the 1987 Constitution and allow them to be able to freely exploit it and not use it for the benefit of the majority of Haiti's people.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Flashpoint senior correspondent Kevin Pina, who is an absolute expert on Haiti and spent many, many a day, week, month, and year on the ground documenting U.S. foreign policy there. And he's a very important player in helping us to understand what's been going on in that country and the geopolitical strategies around that, because we're often so confused by the fact that we hear, oh, Haiti is the poorest nation in the hemisphere, and it's a little bit confusing because it's rich in mineral resource, but the people are poor because the United States keeps undermining the will of the people for corporate reasons. Kevin, is it hyperbole to say that the death squads that we're talking about now are trained by U.S. forces? I heard today in the president in Canada saying, in terms of Biden in Canada saying, it's so important, we're going to make sure that the police in Haiti and other countries have better training so the people are treated better. You want to respond to that?
Well, definitely not directly trained by them, but let's face it, when Haitians today are referring to what are largely touted in the international press, when you read the Miami Herald or the Washington Post, as gangs, as a gang problem, and when Haitians now begin to identify it as a paramilitary problem, there's a big difference in those definitions. Paramilitary structures, of course, mean that they largely resemble a military structure. There is a chef, there's a commander, and there is a subcommand of lieutenants, which is what we largely see in the so-called paramilitary gangs inside of Haiti today. We also know that these are a direct product of a strategy of the PHTK government. Again, a U.S.-sponsored government that came up with, concepts like Haiti is open for business, right? That came directly out of the Clinton Foundation. Or Haiti, build back better after the earthquake. That came directly from the Clinton Foundation, right? The Clinton, as you want to call it, dynasty, when Hillary Rodham Clinton was the Secretary of State and Bill Clinton was the head of the Clinton Foundation and the U.N. representative to Haiti, wielded tremendous influence and power through the PHT government of Michel Martelly, which ultimately became the government of Jovenel Moïse. And we know that those governments collapsed under the weight of their own corruption, that in fact they absconded with billions of dollars after the earthquake. They absconded with billions of dollars of the so-called Petrocaribe Fund, the special fund that Venezuela had set up with oil in the region for poor countries to help Haiti to rebuild its infrastructure. That those same people that were used by the Clinton administration to talk about rebranding Haiti, to enter a new future that's bright for the Haitian people, these were among the most corrupt actors who led to the situation that we have inside of Haiti today. And part of their strategy was to work with gangs, was to build a culture of paramilitary gangs that they could rely upon, that had contacts within the police, that were often run by specific fiefdoms and mandarins within the police department, who later would end up breaking up into these different factions after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse last summer. So really, this is the, while they are not directly trained by U.S. agents, we can say that this is a direct result of U.S. foreign policy, and that the police were trained by the U.S., France, and Canada, because remember that the police had been purged after the 2004 coup, and France and Canada, the United States, committed themselves to rebuilding the Haitian institution in their own image. And we know that that often meant that it was infiltrated by specific intelligence agencies. And we can say that those police have had a tremendous impact in the formation of these paramilitary gangs that today are responsible for destabilizing the country, which of course ultimately benefits the current government, unelected government of Ariel Henry, which is backed by the U.S. government and the core group. And that's what Haitians want people to understand today, that not only have they lost their political sovereignty, but that their country is being actively destabilized by paramilitary groups, paramilitary gangs that came out of U.S. foreign policy that today are making it impossible for them to mount any resistance because their neighborhoods are occupied by these paramilitary forces who have tremendous guns, huge guns. And those guns come from the United States. They're coming through in very large numbers. You can see the gangs bragging about it, the so-called paramilitary gangs bragging about it on social media. You know, there's no secret here of their level of violence and their level of terror that they are committing in order to kowtow, to maintain no resistance in the country. There are no protests of it, you know, that can happen in those neighborhoods. And that is the end result, ultimately, of past U.S. foreign policy handed down to the PHTK through the U.S., France, and trained Canadian police forces that ran those paramilitary forces for the PHTK, who then broke up into different fiefdoms who today maintain the stranglehold on the majority of the population in Haiti.
It's amazing. Just a little bit more about, so all of this, the sort of death squad activity and the sort of emerging killing fields, take us through, well, what's life like on the daily basis? Say, you know, you get deported, you're one of the tens of thousands of people who are violently deported from the United States or the U.S. border, and you get thrown off the plane in Port-au-Prince, and so you have to start your life over. What's it like?
Well, there's no resources. You know, today it's estimated that nearly between 80 to 90% of Haiti's economy is not based upon GDP of businesses. It's based upon remittances of family and friends who are transferring money into that country to keep their loved ones alive. If you don't have a contact with somebody who cares about you outside of the country to send you resources, there's very little for you. There's very little life. You know, it's not only is Haiti dangerous today because of these paramilitary gangs who are controlling large swaths of the capital and other areas of the country, but it's also dangerous because of food insecurity. You know, the you think that inflation is bad in this country. It's been up to 30% in Haiti. So the price of basic goods have gone up. And so really the only infrastructure you have, the only safety net that people have are their friends or family inside of Haiti. If they don't have it, then they're really largely on their own. And it's, you know, it's anybody's guess how anyone in that situation is able to survive. Definitely, I believe it's probably making those communities of the poor that are having to withstand the paramilitary gang violence, at the same time having to put their pennies together, having to create their own unofficial structures and safety net in order to keep some sort of cohesion amongst themselves in those communities where it's even difficult to leave your house to shop, to buy anything, to eat, to get water, to have any sort of life, to send your children to school, to be able to go to the doctor if you get sick. Those sorts of things that, you know, Haitians once took for granted, even though they were poor, are now even difficult on top of that poverty to be able to follow through on. So if you put yourself in that situation, you can see that this is a people of resistance. This is a people of strength who now are trying to find new ways to keep themselves intact, to keep the money, share the money that's coming in from remittances, to build some sort of unofficial system to keep themselves alive in the midst of this amazing, incredibly horrible crisis. And they don't want intervention. They've been through intervention. They know what it's like to have boots on the ground. They also know that those forces, the core group in the United States and France and Canada, are already in their country. They already control their political system. They don't see, you know, there's already been a political intervention. Would boots on the ground be different? Of course, I think many of them recognize that that's a different level of loss of sovereignty, and I think that the majority of the people that I speak with oppose foreigners on the ground. At the same time, they know how difficult it is, life is for them every day, and that it's only going to become more difficult. And that's why it's very difficult when you see these sort of think tanks that are in Haiti that are supported by various non-governmental organizations or have connections with institutions in the United States or in Canada who are putting out these so-called polls that say that the majority of Haitians want foreigners to intervene. It's laughable, because if you look at their connections and then you compare that, if you were to go into the streets and ask the average Haitian, you'd get a very different response, I believe. And that's sort of the folks that I've been talking to. And again, they don't want to hear about gangs. They want people to understand these are paramilitary organizations that still have those contacts with fiefdoms and certain mandarins within the police force, and that ultimately this is only benefiting the U.S.-backed government, the core group-led government of Ariel Henry, and they believe that it is intentional. It is a strategy that is being put upon them to break their resistance.
You know, we're just about out of time, but the last occupation force, sort of the force for the United States, left Haiti with a cholera epidemic, right? So they didn't bode well from the last occupation. The U.S.
More than that, the United Nations tried to cover it up, and they ended up shooting down demonstrators. You know, and then the U.N. tried to cover it up and ended up shooting down demonstrators who were calling out the truth. And then you know how the United Nations covered up their killing of protesters in Cap Haïtien? They said it was intergang warfare, and that of course is another one of the uses of these paramilitary gangs, which is they can always claim that violence against the population is the result of intergang warfare. And how many times have we heard that argument throughout the world to justify repression, to justify low-intensity conflict that had clear political aims to destabilize a particular country and at the same time to maintain the status quo so there could be no change as long as that violence continued to occur?
Oh, man, we're going to leave it right there. Kevin Pina, senior producer here at Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, mastered the subject of Haiti, and it's only getting worse. Kevin, thank you. Really appreciate it. How do people follow your work? Because it's amazing.
Well, you can go to our Twitter account at Haiti Info Project, HAITIINFOPROJ on Twitter.
All right, beautiful. Thanks,
thank you,
Kevin.
Dennis.
Be safe. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk about weapons in space and how to prevent of the expansion leading to a potential galactic war, whatever the hell can happen when you start flying nuclear reactors around space. We'll be back. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, beautiful music. And we're happy to have you along on the Free Speech Radio Network, Pacifica, that we are the People's Radio Network, welcoming now and delighted to do so, Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. This is an incredibly important subject, and our friend has been on it for some time. Bruce Gagnon, it's great to finally get you on the show. The work that you do is crucial. And in terms of weapons in space, people aren't even beginning to think about what the possibilities are. But the United States government has been talking about full dominance in space for some time, huh?
Yeah, actually, I began working on it in 1982. On June 12th, 1982, there were almost a million people protesting in New York City against nuclear weapons during the special session on disarmament at the UN. I was watching it on C-SPAN, living in Orlando, Florida, and afterwards, it was all over the rally, the speakers and everything. They cut away to a right-wing conference, and Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, Ronald Reagan's head of Star Wars, SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, was speaking at this conference. And then in the Q&A, somebody said, "General Graham, aren't you worried there was a million people today in New York City protesting nuclear weapons?" He said, "No, I think it's fantastic because they don't have a clue. We're moving into space. Let them keep doing what they're doing." So, you know, living in Orlando, less than an hour away from the Kennedy Space Center on Cape Canaveral, which has now been renamed to Cape Canaveral Space Force Base, I jumped on that issue, and I've been doing it ever since.
And an important issue it is. By the way, I do remember that rally in New York City because I had a chance to interview Peter, Paul, and Mary. Changed my life. But I do remember it was one of the things that happened at that rally is the box of survivors of the bombing of Japan met with the downwinders from various nuclear bomb factories, you know, in Hanford and others, and they sort of shared details of the impact of the nuclear fuel cycle on humanity. And taking it to space is just the next level of insanity, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. The aerospace industry, working with the nuclear industry, view space as a new market. They want to have nuclear-powered mining colonies on the Moon and Mars and other planetary bodies. They want to have nuclear reactors on rocket engines in order to cut down the amount of time it takes to get to Mars. Presently, it takes a year to get there with conventional rockets. And in fact, NASA is going to start testing a nuclear rocket right above our head in lower Earth orbit in the next couple of years. It's already been approved they can do it. And they say because there are no environmental restrictions, if they did it on the ground, tested these nuclear engines, there would be environmental restrictions. So just imagine they launch a nuclear rocket right over our heads in lower Earth orbit, circling around, practicing firing on and off their nuclear engines, and something goes wrong and it falls back to Earth and burns up on reentry and spreads their deadly toxins across the planet. It's insane. And it's not just that kind of thing that we're worried about. We're also worried about the production process, because you, I'm sure, remember the Cassini launch in 1997 by NASA, a deep space mission carrying 72 pounds of plutonium-238 on board. And in the fabrication process of those plutonium generators at Los Alamos Labs in New Mexico, they had 244 cases of worker contamination. It was reported by one of the newspapers in Santa Fe. So it's the whole process is a problem. We're contaminating the water, we're contaminating the air with nuclear releases at these Department of Energy facilities around the country, and now they want to move it all into space. It's insane. And ultimately, they want to use nuclear reactors for engines to power various weapon systems in space.
And of course, there's a deeper message and a deeper meaning to their policy about full dominance in space, and that is the what they call what's known in the, inside the State Department as the Pacific Pivot, which is the United States' quest program to control, surround China by land, air, sea, and space. And so space is the newest part of that full dominance of planet Earth, right?
Yeah, full spectrum dominance, that's right. Controlling, they want to control conflict at every level, on the ground with their army, in the air with the Air Force, in the oceans with the Navy, and then now space as well with the Space Force. I want to remind people that Trump, when he was president, he signed the Space Force legislation, but it had to go through the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives at the time. They could have stopped it. But in fact, the only thing the Democrats asked for was to call it the Space Corps, like the Marine Corps, rather than the Space Force. So the Democrats were complicit in working with the Republicans to approve the Space Force, this new military branch that's going to be in charge of doing war in the heavens.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we are really happy to be speaking with Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And we're talking about, among other things, various policies that are going to lead the United States government into a space wars race. So many negative possibilities of this policy. Let me ask you this. If there was a nuclear reactor on the Challenger and it blew up over the South, what kind of impact could that have?
Well, let's just go to the environmental impact statement for the Cassini mission in 1997 that NASA had to, they were required by law to create. And in it, they said if there was a launch explosion at the time, like in Challenger, and a release of the plutonium, it would be carried by the winds for a 60-mile radius from the Space Center westward towards the Disney World, southward towards Vero Beach, and northward towards Daytona Beach. And in that whole 60-mile radius, they would have to remove all the people, they'd have to go in and remove all the buildings, they'd have to go in and remove all the vegetation, if you can imagine, and then they'd have to go in and remove all the animals, the snakes, the squirrels, the fish, the alligators. Impossible, right? And then they said they'd have to remove the top inch of topsoil because everything would be radioactive for thousands of years. Well, juxtapose that reality with what just happened in Palestine, Ohio, where they had this toxic release after this train wreck. They couldn't even handle that, right? Let alone imagine 60-mile square radius of nuclear contamination from a space accident. So it's all insanity, and they know it is. But they just lie to the people and make them excited about going to Mars and the moon and everything else.
It's amazing. Do you think that the sort of the apparent expressed love for nuclear power expressed by the Democrats, by the Democratic governor of California, that, you know, all kinds of ways to keep nuclear in the mix, what's the driving force there? Does that make sense?
Well, I think it's money, and in the case of space, it's they're looking for power sources that they can use to mine the sky. There's a big competition right now. One of the reasons why the Space Force was created was to develop the military capability to decide who gets on and off the planet Earth, who can go out and mine the sky in the years ahead. And in a book called Military Space Forces, the Next 50 Years, a congressional study published in the late 80s in the Congress, signed by John Glenn and Bill Nelson and a bunch of other politicians from both parties. They talk about having to develop this capability to restrict access on and off the planet. So nuclear power becomes fundamental, and in that same book they talked about that nuclear reactors were the only known long-lived compact source able to supply military forces with the power needs they would use for weapons in space. So not only mining the sky, but rocket engines to lift these heavy payloads to get out to Mars and half the time, and weapons. So, you know, it's a huge money driver, and it's a power driver.
Again, we're talking about nukes in space. I bring that up because, you know, it does seem that the real driving force in terms of keeping the nuclear fuel cycle going and the so-called peaceful atom is because it's a cover for creating generation after generation of terrible nuclear weapons. Doesn't the nuclear fuel cycle, the so-called peaceful atom, pave the way for the weapons? Is this a part of this cycle?
Oh yeah, absolutely, no doubt about it. They're deeply connected. You can't build nuclear weapons without the without what you get from the nuclear power plants, the civilian nuclear power plants. So that they're connected at the hip. There's no doubt about that. And right now, you know, it's we're living in a really frightening moment as the United States is very brazenly talking about going to war with both Russia and China at the very same time, two nuclear powers. Somehow the United States, that could not beat the Taliban in Afghanistan after 20 years, thinks it can take on two of the other nuclear powers in this world, and it's just pure insanity that we're facing. Now also, Britain has just announced that they're going to send depleted uranium shells along with the tanks that they're sending to Ukraine. Wow. And the use of those would make the incredible topsoil of Ukraine that has always made that country the breadbasket of Europe would contaminate their soil and make their agriculture impossible. And it would kill lots of people, because as these depleted uranium shells blow up on impact, they release these deadly toxins, and when they get inside of people's system, they're going to have serious cancers. The U.S. used them during the early 90s when Bill Clinton and NATO bombed the hell out of Belgrade in Serbia. They left devastating cancerous footprints throughout that entire region. And then they were used again in the Iraq War in 2003. And again, GIs coming back from there with serious problems, and the Iraqi people.
I interviewed them by the dozens. There were so many sick, and so many of them talked about alarms going off by the hundreds, and they were told by their superiors to shut up, that the alarms, it was a bad contract and the alarms were broken, ignore the alarms. There were, I obtained with Pacific News Service a Pentagon document that said, among other things, there was concern, there need to be some kind of awareness to let the veterans know that, you know how they typically collect a few souvenirs to bring home, that they better not do that because they'll be bringing home the stuff that's making them sick to make their family sick. This was an epidemic. Excuse me for interrupting, but it's amazing.
No, that's fine.
Go on, please. It became a forward fighting, along with torture. Depleted uranium became a key forward fighting part of American policy.
Exactly. And now they want to use it on the Russians and inevitably on their own people inside of Ukraine. It's totally crazy, but it shows the desperation of the UK, the US, the NATO war project. They're fighting against a multipolar world. They want to continue control of the world, the resources of the world, by the unipolar West. And the global South has said, we're over it, we're done with it. Asia, Africa, Latin America, China, Russia, Iran, everybody, they're all joining together. They form BRICS. It's an alternative, essentially, to the IMF and the World Bank, BRICS. It stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Now other countries are clamoring to get inside of it. So there's just this mass movement going on right now to leave the West, because the West is all about hundreds of years of colonial occupation of the global South, stealing their resources, using their people as virtual slaves, and people are done with it. And that's what this whole thing is about today. This whole shooting match is about the West trying to hold off this global change that's underway.
How do you feel about a hot war around Chernobyl?
I'm sorry, say that
again. I should
say,
what do you find most hazardous about a hot war around Chernobyl?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Well, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainian government has been shelling it repeatedly. They even shelled it when the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Association or agency, when they were there checking out the place. Russia had taken control of it and was safeguarding it against these Ukrainian Nazis who were continually shelling it. They even shelled it when the IAEA was there. I mean, it's so blatant. So, I mean, why would you shell a nuclear power plant? I mean, it's incredibly stupid.
It's insane. It's insane.
Before we go, can I say hello to my friend inside of San Quentin on death row? I want to say hello to James. I know he's listening to the show, and
I just got, coincidentally, I just got a letter because I'm not working at the station, that James, your friend, sent from San Quentin. It's dated February 1st. And let me read a little bit of it now that you brought it up, because it's such a beautiful letter. And I love we have a prisoners listening group. And he writes, as always, I'm in hopes that these few thoughts and wishes will find you and yours doing well, in good health and spirits. As for myself, considering the current circumstances, I think it's safe to say that I'm doing well. Well, he goes on, you'll first wish to know that I listen to your program religiously and often can convey specific programs to longtime friends, associates, and advocates such as Lewis Wolf, Bruce Gagnon, and we often discuss your guests' names, subject matter during the calls. Anyway, he goes on to talk about the work that you do and other people do that means so much to people who are getting whatever they can learn behind the prison industrial complex, Boris.
Yeah.
So thank you for reminding me.
He's a great man. He's a great artist. He's an organizer. He was thrown in the hole a while back just because he was organizing on behalf of prisoner rights. They took all his property, all his legal paperwork that he's been using to file appeals. It's now been taken away from him, sent away. He can't have access to it anymore. And so he's constantly trying to educate the public and find legal help to speak out on behalf of prisoner rights inside of San Quentin and across California. So he's a real dear friend. We talk frequently.
Maybe we'll get some prison reform from all the extreme right-wingers who are ending up in jail. It seems like you got a little right-wing congressional committee there talking about prison reform. I'm sure our friends in San Quentin will get a kick out of that. Before I let you go, I just have to end this way. It was interesting how many warnings conveyed through the stenographers at various corporate networks that if those Chinese come in there and they aid and they give weapons to the wrong side, you know, so a week of warnings followed by the Chinese show up with the Russians, and what do? Offer a peace plan.
Yeah.
What happens? The West
doesn't
know what to do.
Like they shot the balloons down. They shot the peace plan down.
Right. While they shot them down, while they were busy sending armed, deadly drones that unfortunately got nailed on the way to bombing Russia in this war, which the United States is allegedly sort of semi-neutral. We got to leave it right there. Bruce, you're always a wealth of information. This is an
incredibly... Can I just give
yes.
my website?
Yes, yeah. Please do. Yes.
Our website is spaceforpeace.org, and I invite people to check out my blog, where every day I'm posting things from all over the world, what are going on, and it's called Organizing Notes, N-O-T-E-S. So I invite people to check out my blog, and thank you very much, Dennis. Take good care of yourself.
All right. Be safe. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the Democrats. And are they going to be passing up another chance to control Congress by idiotic politics? Harvey Wasserman is going to talk to us about that. Stay with us. Flying on a 747. Sorry to cut that off. Beautiful piece here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And, here they come again. Harvey Wasserman, the Democrats are desperate to make sure that they don't take control of the House or the Senate. They've been doing stupid things like they're doing these days, like you're writing about in your latest article, that perhaps the Democrats are going to blow a chance in Wisconsin, that they might get the majority. You want to sort of lay that out for us, Harv? Welcome.
Yeah, well, Dennis, it's great to be with you again. The piece is a counterpunch, and basically on April 4th, the anniversary, unfortunately, of the murder of Dr. King, it's a week from this coming Tuesday, there's a special election in Wisconsin for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. And right now the Supreme Court is divided 3-3. It's been 4-3 for the right wing for the last dozen years, but one of the conservatives had to leave. And if the Democrats can take control of the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin, they can get rid of this horrible gerrymandering. The state is ridiculously gerrymandered for the Republicans. They have super majorities in both houses of the state legislature, even though the state is pretty much split 50-50, Democrat, Republican. And they also have 6 of the 8 seats for Congress in Wisconsin, all because of gerrymandering. And the right wing there wants to ban abortion, stop gun laws, all the ridiculous stuff that the MAGA does. And the Democrats have the chance to pick up this seat, and they're spending tons and tons of money on TV advertising, which is a complete waste of money. If they went in with grassroots organizing, which we advocate on our Zoom calls every Monday that you graciously attend, Dennis, they could win. They could get people out to vote. The bottom line is that since it's a very, very off year and a very, you know, obscure kind of election, very, very few people know it's actually happening. And so we have groups like the Center for Common Ground, that's centerforcommonground.org, and Souls to the Polls, which are oriented towards grassroots organizing. Center for Common Ground, you go to their website, and they post an ability to make phone calls into the state to tell people that, you know, in the African-American community that there is an actual election. And there's plenty of statistics to show that it makes a huge difference. I did some phone calling for the Georgia special election for the U.S. Senate seat. It was really fun. Most of the time you leave messages on machines, which is better than a postcard, better than mail, yeah, because people actually listen. And so we want the money that's going into this race to be spent on grassroots organizing, people going door to door, kids at $20 an hour, passing out leaflets, telling people, hey, there's this election. But the Democrats, you know, the consultants who run the Democratic Party, they all get kickbacks on the media buys, and they want to take the money, and they put out these urgent emails which you and I get every 10 minutes asking for money, and then they blow it on TV advertising. We want them to do grassroots organizing, and if they do it, they can win. And this seat could change, and the whole politics of Wisconsin could change. And that's what this is about. It could actually affect the national election.
You know, in terms of buying big media ads, it's almost sort of totally counterproductive, because most of these corporations who control these media companies are not to the left of center. This is just like a big sucking of the information flow. This is, I think, why Pacifica Radio is so crucial in this time, as the one remaining network, pardon the commercial, if you will, that doesn't take commercials, because corporations now control. It used to be the the military-industrial complex. It's now, you got to add a phrase, the military-industrial media complex, because they oil the war machine. Wouldn't you say, Harv?
Absolutely. And in Wisconsin, the Democrats have already spent $9 million on TV advertising for this Supreme Court race. If they spent $9 million paying kids $20 an hour to go knock on doors, they'd win. And it could affect, Dennis, the presidential election next year, because the Republicans are very, very slick at preventing people of color, of youth and color, from voting. And if you actually get people aware and fired up and do the basic groundwork on the ground, you can prevent that from happening. But they don't care. The consultants, as you say, the military media complex, they just spend our money and pay for these ads and get their kickbacks, and they don't care if they win or lose, really. Bottom line here is, if the Supreme Court of Wisconsin moves slightly to the left, it has a 4-3 majority, it can it can stop the banning of abortion, for God's sakes, and it can protect the vote, and that could in fact change the presidential election next year. Wisconsin in 2016 voted very narrowly for Trump, and we know there's a lot of fraud going on. And now in 2020, they voted very narrowly for Biden. And we just had a Senate race infuriating in Wisconsin. They have very, very good progressive candidate, Mandela Barnes, could have won a U.S. Senate seat. He ran against this abomination, Ron Johnson.
Absolutely.
And the Democrats didn't give him the money and didn't do the grassroots organizing, and he lost by, less than 50,000 votes. It's outrageous. And we don't want that to happen again. So people should go to centerforcommonground.org, centerforcommonground.org, and support and sign up and make phone calls. I had a lot of fun making phone calls into Georgia. It was really interesting, and I'm going to do it again for Wisconsin.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Harvey Wasserman. Harvey, we've got a couple of minutes left. Do you want to talk about that? We spent the last segment in a horrifying interview with Bruce Gagnon. It was a great interview, but it was terrifying in terms of the information and weapons in space and all that's going on that front. And it's all around both a bipartisan support of expanding the use of nuclear power / nuclear weapons. Where is the situation in terms of Diablo Canyon and what's happening?
Well, California, unfortunately, is ground zero. You're not that far from the headquarters of Pacific Gas and Electric and want to keep running these two insanely degraded nuclear power plants that could blow up at any time. I mean, Dennis, the issue is not nuclear power. The issue is the nuclear power plants. And the two reactors outside of San Luis Obispo, where more than 10,000 people have been arrested, are just catastrophes in progress. And, our governor, the great liberal Gavin Newsom, has stabbed the environmental movement in the back. These nuclear plants are in violation of all sorts of state and federal laws. And the bottom line is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's own site inspector warned that they should be shut down because they cannot withstand a credible earthquake. These reactors are surrounded by a dozen earthquake faults, any one of which could take it down and send a radioactive cloud pouring into Los Angeles, pouring into the Bay Area, and for nothing, because the power coming from Diablo Canyon is completely inappropriate to the grid in California, and it's really preventing the spread of renewable energy. So we have on our hands, and the whole world is watching Diablo Canyon. It's become the premier nuclear issue. We circulated a petition 3 years ago asking Gavin Newsom to have an independent inspection of these two reactors, which are 40 years old, and he wouldn't do it. And we happen to know that some of the generic structural defects at Diablo Canyon are incredibly dangerous, starting with something called embrittlement. The pipes are cracked. The maintenance hasn't been done. We had a deal to shut it down, and for 6 years, PG&E, which never does maintenance anyway, held off on their maintenance. It is an incredibly dangerous situation. The reactors can't get insurance. They're not really licensed by law. People want to find out more, go to Mothers for Peace, mothersforpeace.org, based in the San Luis Obispo, and you've had the wonderful Linda Seeley on to talk about this. This is really life and death. And all the crazy
is there any way to say, explain, is there any reasonable, I'm sorry to interrupt, and we're running out of time, is there reasonable discussion, is there any reasonable explanation that people, do you buy the governor's sense of that, it's in the context of the greening, it makes more sense, or any way to logically support the expansion of nuclear power in California and the keeping open of that nuclear reactor down south?
No sane human being would ever, who's fully informed, and of course they do a great job of keeping the public in the dark about the realities of these reactors. Again, they're 40 years old. They're full of defects that we know about and many more that we don't know about. But all that has to happen, Dennis, is that one of these earthquake faults goes off, and these two plants will turn into radioactive rubble, and the cloud will, first it will go to L.A. That predominant winds are from north to south, but eventually the winds turn, and it'll go into the Central Valley, and it'll go into the Bay Area, and we're done. You know, nothing else will matter about the economy, about the environment, about human health, once the radioactive cloud comes out of these nuclear plants. And as I say, we have 92. They just opened, they're opening the last of them in Georgia, which is insane. But Diablo is the worst, because any earthquake at Diablo Canyon will result in an apocalypse. There's no other way to describe it. And they have no idea how to stop it. They don't have insurance. They don't have a real license. And it's criminal. And Gavin Newsom has no excuse whatsoever. He signed the deal in 2016 where the state, the regulators, the company itself, the unions, the local communities, the environmental groups, everybody agreed that the Diablo Canyon could shut down in 24 and 25. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, that Gavin Newsom takes more than $1 billion in state money, more than $1 billion in federal money, lines the pockets of his backers at PG&E, and now we're all playing Chernobyl roulette here. It's a nightmare.
Chernobyl roulette. How do people follow? We're out of time, so remind people how they can follow your great work.
MothersForPeace.org. They're in San Luis Obispo. They've been there for more than 40 years. And in Wisconsin, it's CenterForCommonGround.org. And Dennis, you're the greatest.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Harvey Wasserman. And we're out of here.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on